This is Revolution. I know I've mentioned it on the show recently that I work with the unhoused population here in Oakland, California. And I actually had to quit where I was working because of the way, how can I say this? Because of the nonprofit industrial complex. If you are a patron of this show, Kelvin Martinez and I did a whole episode of bonus content about our feelings of the nonprofit world in general. So through Twitter, I discovered today's guest. She has worked in this world for some time. I'd like to welcome to the show, Christy Levitch.
Christy. Hi. Thank you.
How are you?
Hello. I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good.
So you wrote a letter that I saw. I think that's when I reached out to you, when I saw you posted a letter that you had wrote about your employers. And because of a series of events that happened where I worked, there was a COVID positive employee they didn't tell us about. There was a massive lack. It wasn't just a lack of testing. It was policy not to test. Wow. And even when there were COVID positive people, there was no clean. And then an outbreak happened where five third party caregivers became positive. There was definitely crazy problems with violence. Kind of a disrespectful approach when it came to food. That's like the nicest way I can put it. Your letter was the impetus for me to write my 4,500 words on my situation and publish that. So thank you.
Wow. That's
I just
really
wanted to say that publicly. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm humbled and impressed, I guess, if anybody, if that prompted anyone to consider or reconsider. I think that that's actually the intent of any kind of writing like that, right? Is to just pose some questions for us to hold together. So I appreciate that.
Well, the world we're a part of, I think, is a world where it gets co-opted by that do-gooder mentality. Mm-hmm. And it's not really a world of changing systems that cause the problem. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a triage of the symptoms.
Yes.
And when you meet people in that world that are like you, you know, they're like, no, this system is a problem. Like, yeah, and you making me do X, Y, and Z is not going to make anyone's life better. Like, two or three people may come out of this better, mm-hmm. but I can't pat my back on those two or three because there's tens of thousands that are, I mean, I'm just talking about the communities that we live in collectively. We're not talking about in the country and even globally. So I think a lot of people, you're not in this job just to get a check because it doesn't pay that well.
No.
But
no.
Even the people that I vehemently disagree with, I think they have a heart.
Yes.
But it's just enough about my opinion. Christy, can you tell us about yourself, please?
Yes. Yeah. I would love to just kind of jump off some of what you're sharing about the paycheck. Mm-hmm. I think that that's such a huge part of what's preventing people from telling the truth about systems change that's needed in these spaces. You know, I've been working in nonprofit, community-based work, direct social services, education, the arts, basically anything that's outside with our folks in any capacity. I've done a lot of different kinds of projects. And the most striking thing I've observed is that organizations or agencies with like the largest sort of infrastructure and therefore the largest salaries and benefits packages and 401ks and things of that sort, those are the spaces where folks are most resistant to very rarely am I expecting people to, you know, pen a manifesto on systems change in their nonprofit admin job. But just the prompt to have folks tell the truth about what we're seeing and harm that's being done in very simple terms, that even is an extreme challenge, because I think that once you start acknowledging what we're actually seeing and sort of cease the kind of collective gaslighting and tell the truth about what's happening, what starts to crumble away is actually the foundation upon which your career is being built, right? You're on a career track where you go to school, you get a specific kind of degree, that there's a pipeline for that degree in the social service world, right? And everyone knows what that is. You're trying to get to coordinator and then supervisor, manager, associate director, director, right? And you're trying to move up, and folks invest a lot of their emotional, financial, energy into participating in that trajectory. And so if you start to ask questions or tell a truth that, really somehow pulls at the foundation of that, then people get really afraid. And I think that they hold really tight to like the fictions in order to preserve that kind of trajectory. Because what you're being asked in that moment, I think, is, okay, I have an opportunity here to tell the truth about what's happening, what I'm actually seeing, and what kind of harm is being done. And if I tell the truth, then that means I have to somehow figure out a way to detach from my expectations of middle class aspiration, financial stability, because I know that my financial stability is intertwined with the suffering of others ultimately. And so I think, yeah, just coming out of the last few months, I worked for, like I said, some very small organizations that were very grassroots, no funding at all, except for what folks have in their pockets ready to contribute. And I've, you know, worked in organizations with multi-million dollar budgets. And yeah, that seems to be the common thread. That I've discovered the big difference, right?
Do you ever feel like, I had a person on my show, I don't know if you know him or his work. His name is Randy Shaw.
Mm-mm, I don't think I do.
He runs a Tenderloin Housing here in San Francisco, and okay. He's written quite a few books, and his newest book is called Generation Priced Out. Mm. And we were talking a little bit about nonprofits and fundraising, you know, that's kind of a thing with nonprofits. And because housing is done on a federal level, mm-hmm. HUD is a underfunded nightmare.
Yes. Very diplomatic description.
And so when you see all these statistics that always hit the news, right? Every so often you'll see a statistic like we could house all the homeless people in this country with the wealth that we have. Jeff Bezos made so much money during the pandemic, which is what, 6 months since we shut down?
Yeah.
That he could give all of his 800,000 plus employees a $100,000 one-time bonus and still have the $100 billion that he had before it started.
Yeah.
We all see those figures and numbers, and I think we look at it. To me, it makes us look at housing and homeless as not a failure of a system, but as a failure of individuals. Mm-hmm. And because we look at it as a failure of individuals, then the people that choose to work in the world of feeding individuals, clothing individuals, are saints, right?
Yeah.
If it's the church, that's just what the church is going to do regardless. Some, not all, yeah. Right? Or if it's individuals like us, or, you know, insert philanthropist here.
Yeah.
And I don't even think a lot of the people that are philanthropists do it just for tax haven type purposes. I think some people actually really want to do something nice. Mm-hmm. But because it is a business, your foundation, even if you might want to say, I want to not just house the homeless, but I want to like make it where we don't have homeless. Mm-hmm. You may be getting money from someone that doesn't see it your way. Mm-hmm. And you have to pay fealty to the donors. What is your, how do you look at that whole ball of wax?
I was years ago, I read a book you might be familiar with. It's The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. It's a no, I haven't read that. Wonderful book. I'm going to try to look at it. It's came through the work of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. Mm-hmm. And so it's a series of essays written by folks who are leading, you know, really ground level grassroots work in their communities. And it's a discussion of this very thing, right? This like deeply intrinsic conflict that you have where your organization, your coalition of individuals comes together around a really radical idea that's focused on systems change. And through this process of funding, defunding, foundations, grants, et cetera, you slowly sort of whittle away at what was your original move with a spirit of abolition, right? We're trying to abolish the system that created this problem. Slowly over time, it's whittled away because you need to satisfy those funders and because you need to satisfy the people who follow those funders and support those funders and whatever narrow vision they might have, that you end up with at the end of the day or the fiscal year, you end up with an organization that doesn't really reflect what your deeper politics are. And overwhelmingly, the folks who are getting kind of subsumed in this are, you know, Black and people of color led movements where the funding is even more restricted, right? Because there's less access for a number of reasons to these larger funding streams and higher education and all these things that help you get access to those funding streams. And there's, you know, a whole other kind of lineage of politics around that to talk about. But yeah, and so you end up with this idea that looks like sort of a vague representation of what you started with. And it really talks about it. It was so important for me to read that. And it's really, really shaped my path in this work, because every time I come into a new organization or a new project, I really come into it assuming this is not permanent. I'm passing through to do a really specific thing. I'm here to kind of perform a really specific function in order to continue kind of expressing the analysis that I have. And so I came into the last organization I was with kind of understanding how large it was. I understood the context within which it sat politically. And I understood that terrain to be a place where I could really absorb a lot of information and really try to understand on a like a sort of city government level, how do these resources flow? How do they work? What are the real power dynamics? Who's making the actual decisions? And on that end, it was really, really valuable and educational, to say the least, to really have like an up-close exposure to all of that. But what I walk away with is just really it underlined kind of what I went in with, which is what this book talks about. Just the center of that conflict is that the nonprofit industrial complex and this system of funding and platforms, really platforms to speak, sits within a capitalist structure and a commodities a flow of commodities, right? Where poverty is actually also a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
It's something bought and sold, right? And the image of it is also something apart from the actual poverty itself. The image of poverty is something that's bought and sold, and it has its own currency. And as long as this work sits in that context and is dependent on that, it's never going to really look at or address or instigate systems change. And that's not to say you can't do beautiful, worthwhile work in those spaces, because I feel like I have done things that have changed me forever. And I hope that I've been able to care for my neighbors in a way that helps them feel better about themselves and where they're going. But I always have in the back of my mind, like, oh, this really hard work I'm doing today. Overall, I may have this individually transformative conversation or relationship with a client that I'm working with or a person that I'm working alongside. But when we pan out big picture, I understand that my labor too is a commodity in that system. So it can be disheartening and overwhelming to continue for sure. So I guess then, like, if we know that, if we can just say, okay, well, that's what we're dealing with, then what are the options and alternatives, you know?
Yeah, because, and I don't know if you get the same thing where, to your point, you are doing some work that becomes transformative for
yes,
people.
Absolutely.
And you see the attitude change.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to bring in a friend of mine is a basketball coach here at Oakland High School, and he connected me with their, I don't want to say trainer, because he's a little more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than like a strength and conditioning coach. And he would tell me what he was exactly, and I always forget. But he's like a mix of like a real therapist.
Wow.
And like a masseuse, and he just knows how your body's supposed to move
mm-hmm.
for whatever you're doing, sport-wise or life-wise. So because the way the shelters are designed, they were designed to get the most vulnerable of us. So you're getting a lot of older people that have mm-hmm. had years of chronic pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've been sleeping in a car or the sidewalk or a tent or random couches, you probably have some severe issues.
Yes.
And God forbid, whatever you have from just being a person in the world. I mean, I'm 43 right now and I can fart and pull a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm that
mm-hmm.
old. So he came in and I was telling everybody, I'm going to have this guy come, you know, everyone's nervous to have a program, and he comes and there's a cat in there that just limps all the time.
Yeah.
And he looks at the cat and he goes, look, man, you twisted your ankle once, right? And the guy's kind of like shocked that he knew this. And he goes, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to get you walking first. And so the trainer guy looks over at me and goes, look, Jason, he goes, these guys aren't going to be doing jumping jacks anytime soon. So just let them know that whatever exercise they thought they were going to do, no, we're going to have to learn how to move right. Yeah. And then there was and so this guy now can walk upright. And there's
wow.
a woman that had surgery years prior and she had never gotten therapy. And she's like, I can touch my toes and I can lift my arm up now when I go to the shower. And there's a joy everybody gets. And even though the whole hotel wasn't participating, whenever they saw the normalcy of people kind of just outside interacting, having a good time, everybody would come out their room and like watch. And when you're a part of that and you see that change and you see everybody's face light up when they know this good thing is going to happen, you feel good.
Yeah.
And then there's the other side where you know.
Yeah, no, I know. I know. I know that I'm sending this person away from this mm-hmm. kind of magic mm-hmm. to what else is, you know, out there. But I really want to, like, kind of hold fast to those moments, because I think that I think that as much as this overwhelming sort of system of money and commodity and like the use of poor people for a certain benefit is happening, I also think that we have worlds sort of within worlds, right? Where the connection that you're making with that person, with your client or a student or whomever it may be, that is a real world in and of itself. And that is, it is true and it is here with us. And those are the kinds of things that I really try to pay attention to and commit to memory and learn a lot from, because I think that that's showing us actually what's possible. Like, I think the ethic that's in those engagements is something that we can replicate on scale. And mm-hmm. and we can make larger and larger and larger. And so that's why I say too, like folks who are working in this field and in these kinds of systems, I don't think it's an all or nothing, where if you're participating in this, you know, a lot of folks who work in the nonprofit world are also people who have been recipients of nonprofit services, yeah. right? And yeah. so we have a whole complication there. Like a lot of people who are in homeless service work doing outreach out on the street have experienced homelessness, incarceration cycles, mm-hmm. extreme violence and trauma, and they come back into the field to offer that hand to bring folks in. Like we're trying to invite people into our community, right? Back in, to come back in. And there's never going to be anything wrong with that. You know, like that's just a beautiful thing that we need. But I think what ends up undermining that is how the investment that people have in those moments as the worker in a nonprofit, you know, because you feel invested in that moment. I feel loyal to the people I'm working with. I feel accountable to them. Mm-hmm. And that the system that employs me knows that. And I think that's another layer of like objectified labor, right? That you know that I'm going to go the mile for this person. Mm-hmm. You know that I'm going to do it. And so you're going to suck as much labor as you can out of me. And so, you know, not everybody is an admin making 100K a year. A lot of us are out there making 10, 12, 18, yeah. maybe 30.
Yeah.
Which in California is not a whole lot
to live on,
right? Yeah. And you're like a couple paychecks, if that, away from coming back into poverty or homelessness yourself. And so that's like another micro dynamic inside of it too. It's like this whole kind of system keeps moving and keeps going because of the investment and the love that a lot of workers on the ground actually feel, and yet have no agency or power to determine systems wide how this work gets carried out and what the priorities are, you know. But we all have to go back into the streets each day and look folks in the face, give them the bad news about, oh yeah, this housing is actually not going to happen for 6 months, you know, when they saw you as like a beacon of hope. And then you have to tell them, no, I'm sorry, sir, you're on a list now.
And that becomes an issue, right?
Yeah,
like people
absolutely.
Look at you as the man, if you will.
Oh,
right? You're the police, their teacher. Mm-hmm. You're like any authority figure. You just become that person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And even more so if you're working in tax funded or government funded programs, you know, because by default, you're sort of aligning yourself implicitly with all of those relationships. So, yeah.
And as we talk about the national conversation, right, is we're seeing protests constantly. I don't know about where you live in SoCal, but me in the Bay Area, it's not as much as Portland. I think a lot of it died down. I think more people up here focused on, Team Biden or Team Trump.
Yeah.
The election. But defund the police is still a conversation or however you want to name it, abolish police. There's mm-hmm. a lot of different wordings for it. I can only tell people from real world experience why police don't need to show up all the time.
Yes.
And I often tell a story of a woman in particular that, and I think I told this on the show, I'll be brief if I've told this on the show, but I'll keep telling it if show people heard it, me say it, because I think it's a story that needs to be told kind of ad nauseum until you understand that this is a problem.
Yes.
Had a woman that was severely mentally ill, bipolar and schizophrenic, and had a problem with alcohol and had a problem with hard drugs. These shelters are wet, which means people can use drugs. It was around the first, and she would have to go out to go, you know, hook for her dude and get money for more drugs, right? Yeah. And in the process, she would get real effed up, and she was a tiny woman, a very mm-hmm. tiny woman, and she'd get very violent when she'd get real, real effed up. And I'm trying to take her back to her room and she just won't go. So security comes, we're trying to take her back to her room. She won't go. So I asked her, I was like, hey, are you afraid to go back to your room because your husband beats you? And she starts crying and she says, yes. So she's already gotten beaten up by another resident if I leave her outside. Mm-hmm. And this is of a hotel, huge complex, right? So I can't leave her out there because somebody will. I can't watch her 24 hours. Somebody might fuck her up. But I also don't know if inside is the best place for her. Another woman who also is in the life grabs her and says, I'll take her to her room. And she goes to the room. And I didn't have to call police that day, but I was told that she had a mental health team. Mm-hmm. I called the mental health team while all this is going on, and mind you, there's like 300 and some people in this facility, 320 something, I think at the time. So we were pretty much at capacity, and you've just taken the street and put it in a hotel. It's not like,
yes, exactly.
The rules don't apply anymore. So you can't go around walking around telling people you're about to fight them and all this stuff. And at some point, someone's not going to go, you're not taking your medication and I'll leave you alone. Someone is going to hurt you. I called the mental health team at 4:45 on a Friday and they're like, nah, we're not coming out. And I go, well, I don't want to call the police. They go, call the police.
Wow.
They're like, we're not coming out. It's 4:45 and it's Friday. We got one person and that person's on the other side of town. So even if I told them to come over there right now, they're not going to be there before 5. And I said, you got to have a mental health crisis during banking hours. And yeah. I said, you call the police, and hung a phone. I asked this question to anyone listening. Do you think it makes sense to call armed law enforcement on a woman obviously having a break, that's dealing with violence from so many different angles, and she's in the safe place, right? She's in the shelter. You take that man away, now she doesn't have some of the means that she had before just to survive.
Yeah.
It's complicated. And I feel like it's hard for the average person to look at that and have an answer. But that's the question I want to pose to America. This is the situation that a lot of people in our unhoused communities are in, be it a federally run shelter, be it a tent city. This is real life. And law enforcement kind of ain't the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, too, that not to get too heady with everyone, but I'm always wanting to look at sort of the history of the institutions here that are actors in this kind of a scenario, you know. the history of the institution of policing in America. And then, of course, individually in certain cities, we have very specific histories. Like in Los Angeles, we could do a whole long series about the history of policing in Los Angeles, right? But as a whole, you know, we understand the history of the institution of the police, capital P, began as a way to keep enslaved Black people on the plantation, on the land of the folks who claimed ownership and conducted patrols anytime anyone would get the idea that they wanted to free themselves and move away from that space. And so that's where it started. And so that's just the first truth telling. So the function of police is to organize and enforce control over property and people being in that moment perceived as legal property. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the history of the mental health institution of the United States. And so it's only really very recent history that the mental health field and mental health care has kind of taken on an aesthetic of, you know, client-centered work, trauma-informed care, all these really wonderful vocabulary words that I do think we should be using and practicing. That's very, very recent. Prior to that, mental health institutions and mental health workers were also engaged in a form of system control, right? We can't have people with like really blatant disabilities or uncomfortable behaviors for middle class American life that just doesn't fit here. We put people away. And so folks were, you know, really locked away. And so that's really important to note too. And I think as many as much as people go into the mental health field, which I know quite a few people, I have lots of therapists and clinicians in my life that I love and respect dearly, but I think they too are grappling with the history of that institution. And then now in these times, like how do we motivate the working of that institution to kind of undermine its inception, right? And so the same can be said for policing. Yeah. And so in that moment, like as you're describing this scenario, and I've certainly encountered many, many, many scenarios that sound identical. I think about what does that mental health clinician on that team, and then, you know, by default, what does the organization that they work for, how do they consider themselves in terms of their role within a community infrastructure? And I would pose the same question to police, but I think we understand how they view their role. It's not too much of a mystery. But what we see is like the funding is there for cops to be on call 24/7, right? The resources are there, the people power, there's enough people to do that job. There's enough cars and there's enough uniforms and radios and all this kind of gear to keep cops on call 24/7 and just, you know, nobody needs to look very long to see there's just not enough resources to keep this mental health team on call 24/7. And so I don't think that, you know, you have to even get into all kinds of lefty politics to just do some basic math, right? That what's going to happen, you call the cops, let's say she gets arrested. Maybe she's been incarcerated before. It's highly likely considering how she's supporting herself, right? And so maybe she reenters the carceral system. That's more tax money, right? That we're, you know, collectively spending to support now a prison pipeline for this individual, the court fees, the lawyers, et cetera, housing in a prison, all of which could have been curtailed, right? It could have diverted to a completely different direction. And so just like the brass tacks of it, just the math, what defunding the police is talking about in this moment, which I would also argue for a defunding toward abolition, but that's another, it's another chapter.
You won't scare them all off on
right. No, just come here with me. We're just talking about money right now. Everybody likes to talk about money, right? So we just want to say right now, defunding just looks like being realistic and actually responsible with the limited resources we have and the problems that are actually present. But I think that because mental health, despite its desire as an institution or as a field of study and labor, wants to consider itself progressive and for healing of individuals and communities, which I believe a lot of people, that's why they get into it. Historically, it doesn't function in that way. And so what we're not tackling is what we want that field to look like in this moment. How does it function? What is its role in a city infrastructure, in a community infrastructure? And it is still carrying around the baggage of being an extension of the police state, right? A form of control over bodies that are undesirable in the ideal. And the ideal is, right, a white, middle-class, able-bodied worker, attractive, you know, all these things that we could list a million attributes that make that picture of the ideal person who's allowed to be in public. And until, I don't know, I feel like until we unpack and untie some of that as well, we're not really going to invest. As I think what people are thinking about when they're like sitting at home and going like, okay, these weirdos want me to defund the police and they want me to put all this money into mental health care. All right, how do I understand this? I want a job done. I want this person who's undesirable in my community to get quote unquote taken care of. I want them basically gone. I don't want to have to deal with it. And so we're already giving money to the police. We should just keep doing that because, you know, and then almost seeing like the offering of mental health care as in the same vein as housing. Like, why should you get free housing or free healthcare or free mental health care if I have to go to work and work for it and I don't even get enough of that stuff.
Exactly.
Right? And so, yeah, it's a very like it's a severe entanglement, right? But I think this is like an amazing moment. I'm so excited. I mean, I'm devastated by so many things not even on the daily. Like, let's be real. Like every hour, I feel like I'm looking at social media. I'm like, oh my God, what kind of healing work do I need to do tonight just for myself to like have the capacity to continue, you know? But contrasting that, what a beautiful moment that we have people on mainstream television saying the words defund the police, right? That would not have,
yeah,
it just would not have been the case. It would not, to be perfectly blunt, it would not be on the lips of anyone in that capacity if it were not for the Black Lives Matter LA chapter that started here in this city 7 years ago. What beautiful work to like push that vocabulary into the hands of so many people. So I do think it's an incredible opportunity, and all of that wisdom and knowledge and the way to do this work has been laid out. These folks have done this work already. Me personally, I just need to activate that agenda. That's what I need to do each day, right? I need to pay attention to what folks who know are saying needs to be done and then activate it. That's what I'm here to do, is listen and pay attention and activate that. I should clarify too, that I'm a white person doing this work and in this role. So I think that means something too.
It's to the point of the conversation changing. I also think, like, as happy as I get about that, and I had Alex Vitale on the show, who actually wrote the book, The End of Policing, I want to say mm-hmm. like 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. As much as I am behind the chant to defund the police, I totally understand how polarizing that those
absolutely.
Words are for a lot of people, because to your point, I don't think people understand that cops don't save you.
Yes, they don't, yeah.
When they, I swear I've said this on the show before, but again, another one of those things you have to keep saying.
Yeah.
When you're someone's breaking into your house, if you're home, which is not going to happen too often, that officer's going to arrive after it's over.
Yes.
It's unless you live in like Mayberry or a super suburb where there really isn't much for police to do.
Yeah.
And then really someone breaking your house while you're there is like some crazy horror movie like situation that's happening to you. Like, well, then the stars have aligned.
Yeah.
But their role is to be somewhat reactionary, right? Mm-hmm. A wrong was done to me. I need you to come here and try to fix said wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we really defunding?
Mm-hmm.
When we see these protests, to quote the great Martin Luther King Jr., the riot is the voice of the unheard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like police are saving you from protest violence. So if that's what your concern was, like, will the police save us from these larger issues? And mm-hmm. what about crime in the communities? And because what happens is, I'm from a bad area mm-hmm. in the Bay Area, a place called Richmond, California. It was ghetto as shit when I was growing up, and it still is pretty ghetto now. And I saw all the things that you see mm-hmm. when you live in a bad area, USA. And through doing music, I got to go to a lot of quote unquote bad areas all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them look alike.
Yeah.
A lot of the people that live in the bad area, you're kind of trained that police are going to be the ones that save you. Especially when your area starts getting bad problems with drugs. In crack in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the laws we have now, the people in the community asked for those laws. There's a great book called Locking Up Our Own by James Forman Jr. where he discusses that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we fight against our own best interests. And then when it gets to this point, here we are in 2020, where law enforcement is just, I don't even know if they're running amok more than they were before. Maybe we just see it more because of the mm-hmm. advent of camera yeah. phones.
Yeah.
But they just do what they want to do. And now people are going, well, I'm tired of them shooting my child.
Yes.
I'm tired of my child telling me that they came home and got searched or whatever the situation is yes. that was uncalled for. And it's like, yes, so we need to defund the police. There is no, but what if, no, we need to defund the police and take that money that we spend in Kevlar vests and tear down your house tanks and put that into real mental health professionals
mm-hmm.
that can come to these situations gunless. Mm-hmm. And we will see such a decrease with these officer involved shootings. It's almost like people think, well, if there's no police, or if they don't have all the weapons, then people don't have repercussion. Murders happen regardless. Mm-hmm. Police aren't scaring murderers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, isn't it so much about punishment?
Yes.
Right? It's, and this is, I mean, this that the punishment conversation takes us way back, right? Public punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Public punishment. How dare you do X, Y, and Z outside of your social or political position? How dare you, right? And then you're going to be punished for that. I mean, I think it's a deep belief that people have that people who do wrong deserve to be punished. And so you're right. Police are showing up on site. They're not preventing any crime. They show up after the crime, so-called crime, has been committed. And they are there to exact retribution.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like an institutionalized revenge.
That's a good one, yeah.
On behalf of, right, the complainant, the person who was allegedly harmed. And we know who the complainant is. Like, we know who that character is historically. And yeah, so I don't know. I think that it's going to take two things for me that I've been thinking about a lot, you know, in conversation over the last, especially the last year, like really talking to a lot of folks in LA who are doing amazing work. I'm just in awe of these organizations, K-Town for All, Ground Game LA, Sela, doing incredible work that's combining mutual aid work, political advocacy, extremely responsive organizing. Like, I don't understand how fast these folks are moving. Like it's pretty amazing. And, you know, having lots of conversations with all of these organizations and really trying to process, like, what is it going to take? What is it going to take? It feels really overwhelming. And just coming out of these talks and in these, you know, as I'm learning from a lot of people doing this work too, I feel like it's two parts. Like there's like one arm of it is a really deep cultural change where we're talking about having hard conversations, uprooting the imagery of white supremacist, settler, colonial capitalism that has produced this condition, right? And so that's, we need to address what this looks like. What are the aesthetics of our public spaces? What are the monuments we still have erected in these public spaces? What is the design of our housing? What do our public parks look like and how do they function, right? So there's these like what are the bones of the cities that we live in? How do we speak to one another? How do we engage with one another? And so these are cultural changes, cultural conversations. And then the other part of it is, and that, mind you, that's not cultural change, cultural initiatives towards like cultural understanding in the like feel good kind of teaching, you know, tolerance and all that nonsense. Like that's, I definitely don't mean that, but really, really doing some like deep work to change kind of the bones of how we are together. How do we be together? And then on the other side of it is just political force. I don't think that cultural change is here in my life, the way I want to do it and am doing it, to change the hearts and minds of people that are dead set on continuing to harm the most vulnerable members of our communities. I'm not here for that. I don't need to convert you. And so I invest a lot of energy too into thinking about what does political force look like? So I've hit some dead ends over the years in trying to think about, like, you know, I think the first approach is always like, oh, we have to appeal to the empathy muscle in whomever is in charge. And we see that just does not work. We see that just does not work. There are bare facts laid out in front of people about what works and what doesn't. Just today, coming out of UCLA, some folks working out of UCLA reposted another study about just what needs to happen for the hotel system to really work for housing people. And it's a brilliant paper. It lays it all out. Like the research is there. Scholars devoted to this have offered it to all the electeds, all the folks in the seats that make these choices. The appeal to the empathy muscle is not working. And so there needs to be, there has to be another route to changing it. I also don't like, I don't really engage with the so-called like NIMBY conversion conversations. Like, I don't care. I, at this point in my life, and I won't even call it a career. This is just like what we're waking up to do every day. I'm interested in unsettling this territory. I do not care to try to convince you why this human being who sleeps in a tent down the street from your condo isn't allowed to be here. I'm just going to do what I need to do to make sure that they get what they need. So I'm kind of like, I don't know. I'm just not in a space these days to even say like, well, let's just, you know, people have their opinions and they, no, if your opinion is, if the practice of your opinion in the world results in the physical, emotional, psychological, cultural harm of anyone, you're not entitled to that opinion. It's just a fact. So, yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at. I don't know. The last couple months of, I hadn't thought I could be any more radicalized. and then, you know, the last 6 months or so, pushing all of us, right, to like think in really different terms. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing, but it also means there's a lot of work ahead of us.
Are you radicalized kind of by, I don't want to say radicalized. Has this administration kind of pushed you further into being radicalized, or is it, or does the lockdown help?
You know, no, actually, I mean, okay. So I think that I've been reflecting on this a lot lately. Having just been involved in, you know, sort of conscious or politically activated kind of communities for a long time now, I think I can identify some really specific moments where I felt in myself a turn toward a more radical way of thinking. One of them is like the months after September 11th, I was 18 years old and I was in a community college class on that. I was taking a community college class, like an art class or something. And so I was just in this really immersed. I was really immersed in my own way of thinking, like what I was examining, how I think a lot. And that really pushed me. I was also working in a public school and I saw so quickly how the school structure, the way that the high school was being run, really moved toward this very authoritarian space, a really fear-driven, ultra patriotic space. And so that pushed me to doing activism, like what I would call activism around all that happened after September 11th. And then years later, I had an experience in 2006 when the LAPD unprovoked attacked really an immigrant rights or an immigrant affirming march for May Day 2006 and corralled all those participating into an intersection. And it was extremely violent. And that was I had had shitty run-ins with cops since I was a kid in really specific ways. But this was the first instance where I was physically harmed by a police officer and was this was the first time that my body was really engaged in that kind of an altercation. And it absolutely changed. Like, I feel like it changed me on like a molecular level. Like my body would never feel the same seeing or being around police after that. And so that was really huge. And then it was all just veering left, from there until I kind of fell off. And really like situating that experience in an understanding of race and white supremacy and migration on this planet and land politics, right? And so kind of that carried me. And so in 2016, I was in graduate school when he was elected. I wasn't surprised at all, but I was really afraid for people I love and devastated. But I wasn't surprised. And I don't think that necessarily radicalized me. I just at that point felt like, okay, now there's going to be a different kind of work to do. And so, you know, checking in with folks and plugging in ways that felt helpful for that. I think the COVID situation and in particular working on the street and with folks who are working on the street daily, working with and alongside people that are experiencing homelessness, that has really changed, not changed, but like it blossomed. It blossomed my understanding. Something that I thought theoretically going into this job, I understood the infrastructure politics, but this was a way for me to very practically experience it and experiencing it as I engaged in speech to discuss it and then feeling the backlash from that and seeing the inner workings and kind of all that ensued around that was really educational and has definitely put me in a place where I do not anticipate working for another organization in my life again, unless I run it. So
that's fair.
With others, you know? And so I definitely took a big turn. And now I, you know, because I understand homelessness as a phenomenon, as a thing that is existing and has existed since the inception of this country. I understand it.
Enclosure of the commons.
Yes. And I understand it as a part of, it is a part of deep historical land mismanagement, enslavement and genocide. And whether it's, whether homelessness today is impacting a white person, a black person, a queer person, any, it is all wound up, bound up in that larger system. And so I'm really interested in looking at housing and infrastructure through the lens of unsettling it, untying it, undoing it, and really like taking cues from folks that I love and collaborate with. There's a great organization in LA called Metzli Projects, co-founded by a dear friend, Joel Garcia, who's a LA-based artist, grew up on the East Side, East LA, Boyle Heights, and they're doing amazing work around, and he's doing amazing work around really reflecting on the function of monuments and to what are we paying tribute to and how does that manifest in public space? And then really also like the politics around resources and how those resources get doled out to people who get to author public space. And he's doing it and this organization is doing it from the positionality of indigenous folks living here in Los Angeles on Tongva land, unceded Tongva land. So yeah, so I'm just at this point, yes, probably more radicalized. Maybe radicalized isn't the word. Maybe I feel more committed. I felt a renewed commitment. Yeah.
I feel you on that.
Yeah.
I actually thought more people would be radicalized by COVID.
Yes.
I thought, I mean, like everybody else, I didn't know how long this thing was going to last. And as more epidemiologists started speaking that I actually trust, people like Lori Garrett, and you realize that federally this has been mishandled really, really badly. Like I found a couple articles actually about the mishandling of COVID. I actually put one on Twitter and for a reason no one cared. I thought that was funny. The Woodrow Wilson administration actually was accused of badly handling the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu was so badly handled from a federal perspective for all these European nations. Like the first of all, the reason why we call it the Spanish flu, no one really knows why, but Spain was the only country that was reporting their numbers accurately because they weren't involved in the war. The other warring nations were like, well, we can't tell you that what numbers we have, because then you'll know that we have decimated troops. Wilson actually got the Spanish flu at that the treaty, the Paris Treaty. So I guess when things are that big, you know, you mishandle them. 50 million died back then. Mishandling something in 1918 definitely isn't mishandling something in 2020.
Yeah.
We've all seen the pictures of cats wearing masks at events. But I thought when the numbers for housing, because I felt that was something that was really, really badly, just the way the CARES Act came out was kind of the epitome of Pelosi, Schumer, McConnell, like just kind of years of a neoliberal agenda to not really care about the working class or just the people in general. The number is at 30 million Americans are looking at possibly being homeless. No one continues to offer any sort of solutions. It's just always a kind of, well, we'll just wait till tomorrow. Can we wait it out to this election? Neither party really cares, because it's going to be a fundraising point on either party, whoever wins. If the Democrats win, the Republicans will see, you know, the Democrats totally fall on their face trying to do something about this new problem. And I feel like once you become homeless, once someone sees you sleeping in your car, then you start to get looked at totally as an individual, as the mistakes that they project upon you that you have made. Be it drugs, be it alcohol, be it you not being responsible because there might be kids in there. Like, there's going to be so many things that people project upon you, and like empathy won't be one of them. Maybe you get some leftover food or something, or maybe somebody wants to buy you groceries one day, or just, but ultimately you are the visual problem that nobody wants. And my big fear with COVID is when it's all said and done and we've gotten the hotels and all these other things that we have for the unhoused, I feel like it's going to be a way to demarcate where the class system sits. Yeah. More so than redlining was during the New Deal. Because I see where the hotels are in Oakland, mm-hmm. and the community around them and the environment around them. Like, this is just in a bad neighborhood that nobody cares about. So you can do anything you want. If it was in downtown Oakland in a nice part of town, then maybe the news would want to come out and do stories about this stuff. But our hotel within the first month caught on fire. It was a huge fire. It damaged a whole tower. News didn't show up. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
And I was hoping COVID would be the thing where we would kind of rally around each other to push, to really push for politicians to have some sort of legislation that our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world have. I mean, France just said they're getting, 84% of their salaries paid for furloughed workers through the summer. China did an amazing job. Some people might disagree with me, but they set up hospitals. They hired thousands of people, and we're not even looking at a jobs program. We could have employed so many people just to do testing instead of leaving it for the private sector to do. We could have had a public jobs program for testing, cleaning.
Yeah, I think that moment that you're describing, like that this is the moment for people to rally around, I don't think it's expired yet. I think, unfortunately, though, it will need to get worse, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I'm sad saying that. Like, I don't say that like flippantly, because I know what that means for it to get worse.
As I talk to you today, Christy, California surpasses 15,000 deaths from coronavirus.
Yeah.
The LA Times had a story a few days ago about, Room Key. I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. Mm-hmm. So far, roughly 4,100 people have been housed in hotels across Los Angeles County, far short of the program's 15,000 person goal. Mm-hmm. The city's report focused only on hotels in LA that received taxpayer assistance or were built on sites currently or formerly owned by the city or its former redevelopment agency. None took part in Project Room Key. Mm-hmm. According to the report, some of the hotels were involved in other programs during the COVID-19 pandemic, such as housing medical personnel. Some were deemed to have logistical issues, such as elevators that increased infection risk. That's bullshit. Mm-hmm. And some gave no reason for their lack of interest. Just on the whole elevator thing, the way we ran our hotel, we were a COVID, quote unquote, a COVID free site. So you had to be negative of COVID to be in our site, but there were COVID sites with elevators, and there were ways to use elevators. It was either like non-COVID working personnel only uses elevators, or residents only use elevators and non-COVID personnel uses stairs.
Yeah.
So it's a little more walking. I definitely walked up my share of stairs. When we first started with the program, it was like, damn, I did 8 miles a day.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, walking up and down stairs, but that's BS. A lot of these hotels said that they didn't want their reputation sullied by having homeless people staying at their hotel.
Yeah.
I can attest to the fact that the Radisson got constant calls when this whole thing first started. People saying, I will never stay there again, knowing that they house homeless people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of truth in that. You're down there, so what's your take on everything down there from that standpoint? From that standpoint,
we need another hour, James. I think, I don't know. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about what it means to people to bear witness to how the suffering caused by the experience of homelessness, that when people who are housed and have not touched that experience bear witness in public or at a distance, and what that the currency of that image is in the mind of people who are participating really fully in American capitalism. And it, like what you're pointing to around, like, it all that will and has been transpiring to basically designate an entire class of people as like an underclass, a new underclass. I think there is a very deep fear of becoming that for people who are bearing witness to it as they're going about their day, or when they're approached with this question, like, hey, can you use your massive building to house, you know, a couple hundred people, to even be associated with people who are members of that class, is striking folks as, and somehow a reflection on them individually. So, I mean, that's, that's a deep values structure there. It's really disappointing and upsetting. I could never imagine having that kind of, I really spend a lot of time actually wondering, like, how do people think that way? Or how do they feel? Like, I'm really, it's curious and strange to me, because I really don't, I'm not able to understand how you would have that reaction. But I think that's just one part of why this, what could have been a really amazing project, didn't pan out as well. I mean, I think it's, yeah, one part, like, what are the attitudes around homelessness and proximity to homelessness that mm-hmm. cause people to reject a participation in this project? And then there's who stands to benefit from it working is another question.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, a lot of people probably surveyed the outcomes of this and said, oh, I don't really stand to benefit either politically or financially from the success of this project. And it's a very practical and pragmatic, honestly, like a very kind of capitalist filter to say, like, oh, the mm-hmm. cost benefit here is not working out, so I'm not going to do it. And that includes our elected officials, right? Like, will my proximity to this project produce an outcome politically in that I will become reelected or solidify an upcoming election, et cetera. And then there's like, how does the infrastructure that's supposed to carry out this project even work? And that is like a whole other failure. Because it's an infrastructure in terms of the social services structure and system in Los Angeles. It's an infrastructure that's wrought with gaps and holes and missteps and problems without the added pressure of a pandemic and urgency. Not that there isn't already urgency, but this is like another level of health urgency, right? And medical urgency. And so in my experience, you know, I have found, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who have participated in the program and as residents, and, you know, what we had on the face value, you know, speaking to a client's perspective, I can't speak from that perspective, but just what the feedback was for me was that it felt as if there was this incredible kind of transaction that had to take place, where people were asked, and this is very common with, you know, the shelter, it's the shelter pay. This is what you pay to be in a shelter, is you have no autonomy. You're not able to come and go. You are treated essentially like a child who doesn't know their own life, like, and how to do your life. You have to get rid of your belongings, including vehicles, because a lot of the sites in LA do not have parking. And so I've talked to a lot of people who were living in their car and they really wanted to come inside and participate, but they would have had to sell or like give up their vehicle. And then, and then because they wouldn't have a place to legally park it for that long. And then when the project ends, they don't even have a car to live in. Right. And so they were unwilling, in some cases, unwilling to give up the vehicle. In other cases, they were able to, you know, Mickey Mouse something together. But that was it's like asking someone to give up their 3-bedroom house in the burbs, you know? It really is.
We definitely had people that left. I can tell you, I'll tell you a true story about someone that left. You know, I'm giving no fucks in this conversation with Christy. We had a woman that was severely mentally ill. Every time she spoke, some gnarly shit came out her mouth.
Yeah.
One night she had destroyed her room. She definitely had a problem with methamphetamines, but you know, bad things had happened to this woman throughout her life.
Yeah.
And I think another thing is when you look at homelessness from an arm's length away, right, as the pedestrian walking down the street, sure, in a big city like San Francisco or downtown LA that has a ton of it too. You see these people, sometimes you see them shooting up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see him smoking meth and you're like, okay, well, that person's a drug problem and that's why they're all fucked up. Mm-hmm. And you don't sit there and have to have a conversation with them. You can give them food and they're very, very thankful because that's their hustle. Mm-hmm. When they don't have to hustle, not as thankful, not as nice, different conversation. They're not bad people. It's just a different conversation.
Yeah.
So this woman, I got to call her like, hey, man, room, blah, 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 she's tearing her room up and you have to do something. So security in these places, too. I really hate the company that they hire for security. Their job was to observe and report. They didn't do anything. And so I get up there and this lady has taken her entire room apart. She's taken everything off the wall. I'm still trying to figure out how she took apart the heating unit, AC unit. So this is our hotel rooms. They get their own hotel rooms. You're not sharing it with anybody, right? Because you're supposed to shelter in place. Yeah. And, you know, you got to go. Not forever, but tonight you got to go because you just fucked this shit up and you can't. And she's trying to start fights with people. It was just all bad. I was every bitch in the book. She called me every bitch you can call somebody. No lie, Christy, probably for about 30, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Till she finally got to the gate. I was every kind of. She didn't call me. She was a white woman. She didn't call me the N-word, surprisingly enough. So she had enough wherewithal to know that that wasn't cool. But I definitely was a lot of kinds of bitches.
Yeah.
So she fucked the room up. They let her back in. Told her that she had to take her medication. She didn't take her medication. She put in another room, and she destroyed that room. And they're like, "Well, we're not gonna deal with her anymore." Mm-hmm. And she lived across the street by the freeway on ramp, and there was no under ramp. It's just like a field. So she lived in the field.
Yeah.
And no one noticed. No one in management that kicked her out noticed that the lady was across the street. And once in a meeting I mentioned, I was like, well, it seems like you guys don't care about violent guests. You just care about guests that destroy capital. And they're like, well, what do you mean? I was like, well, the woman that destroyed her room is literally living across the street. Like, she waves to me. And they just kind of shrugged their shoulders and looked at me. And it's like, it's an anecdotal joke that they can tell over dinner. Like, he wanted to hear something crazy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what drew me to you, because I saw maybe some sort of like kindred spirit that sees that as some sort of injustice.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't the biggest fan of this woman, because, you know, there's only so many bitches I can get called before I go, you know, I'm not going to respond to that call.
Everybody has the capacity to be an asshole is something I've
learned. Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a form of, I'm going to respect your dignity and say that no matter what your lot in life is, everybody has the potential to be an asshole. And she might have been an asshole. But the thing is, it's not about whether we like or feel pleasant about a person, where someone is the right kind of, mm-hmm, quote unquote homeless person who is, mm-hmm, grateful and has like a compelling story and is, mm-hmm, really sweet and meek and says thank you all the time and cries and tells a story on a stage for all the fun. Like, that's that anybody, like, the further you get from that image as a you know, kind of poster person, like, the less people are willing to put up with, quote unquote, this is not a term I would use, put up with your shit. Right. And so, so like when we say harm reduction, trauma informed care, for me, harm reduction also includes a real deep look at like the practitioner of this service who is offering this resource and responsible for facilitating its meeting the client. You need to be taking a deep look at yourself, which sounds like you did, and understand this person in within like a harm reduction framework, that their behavior is also a thing potentially that could produce harm to them, because it is unpleasant, because it's not ideal, because it's difficult, et cetera. All these, it's uncomfortable or weird, right? Like, it's bizarre. The behavior is bizarre. And to the practitioners of this work, like, it's not really about you and what you like to listen to. I have had some really hard conversations with people. And in particular, it's been really, really challenging for me. Like, I've worked with men who are sexual predators and they're living outside, you know, and they have a history of sexual predation, and I'm a woman and I have a child, you know, there's all kinds of stuff in there. I have worked with white people who are extremely racist, you know, and I have to find ways to, I am going to provide this service with you. I'm going to do this with you. I'm going to do what I can to connect you. But I'm still going to say, excuse me, sir, that's an inappropriate word. You know, we're still going to have a hard conversation, because I respect this person as an intelligent individual who is wants to be accountable and wants to engage, just like I do, right? And their unpleasant behavior or their difficult behavior or it's like mysterious. People are like, oh, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. Well, that's fine. But that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not this person deserves to live inside and have food and healthcare. Like their behavior is irrelevant. Like you could be so many things and I'm still going to give you a plate of food, right? Like it's irrelevant. But we get caught up as practitioners of this work. And then especially in people in leadership, again, I think it's like the people are really commodities in these spaces and it's a cost benefit analysis, you know? And so we want the thing that's going to get us from A to B the quickest using the least resources, right?
Oh God, don't get me going about how they use the least resources. But because, you know, in this lady's, you know, denunciation of me being a lot of bitches.
I'm going to start using that phrase now.
A lot of bitches?
Yes.
I wish I could see you right now. So the last thing she says to me, she's got, at this point, she's out of her room. She's got two shopping carts filled with bullshit because, you know, that's what happens in these situations. And she's telling me some shit in between me being a bitch that is fucking my head up because she's telling me that I just want to rape her again. I'm like, I don't know you.
Wow.
But I don't know what she's seen.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know what she's been through. You don't get to this point in life.
Yeah.
Without going through some shit.
Yes.
And now I'm hearing the shit she's going through because it's just coming out. This is something I'm doing is triggering her, probably telling her that she got to stop tearing shit up.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to be cool with her at first. You know, where are you from? Oh, I'm from the same city. And then that's when I was all kind of bitches. And try to talk to me, old bitch ass. So at the very end, and we're laughing at this point because if I don't laugh, then I got to laugh because there were some creative ways to call me names. She gets quiet and she reaches into her pocket and she pulls out a rolling paper and she pulls out. It was so brown and dry. I don't know if it was tobacco or shitty weed. I don't know what it was, but she pulled out something. She rolls her cigarette and she looks over at me and she inhales and blows out real cool. She goes, so whose butt did you fuck last night? I had no response.
No.
And there was about five other security guards next to me and everyone was just rolling on the floor laughing like, well, I don't even, there's nothing I could say. I didn't, but there's nothing I could say to that.
She ended the show.
She ended the show. And I was like, that's bravo to you. Because you ended it well. And
yeah.
But,
but I think, you know, I don't know you really well, but I gather that in that moment, you didn't take that personally, right?
No.
Like you knew. You are in that moment, you are playing a character in this person's world. Mm-hmm. You represent a whole lot of power actually, because you're part of this institution to her, right? Even though we all know internally in that institution, you pretty much have no power, right? Because of the structure of that, right? But from her vantage point, and I've definitely experienced this working for like a government funded agency. You walk up to that, into that space, and you are playing, you today are playing the role of nonprofit lackey who wants to take my shit and tell me what to do. And I have no power, and I'm going to exact power. I'm going to push power in whatever way I know, whatever way I can. Right. And sounds like she did that.
make a scene and and all I wanted her to do was not fight people.
Yes. Yeah, that would be nice.
Just hey, stop throwing shit and fighting people. But go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, even in that moment, I see those moments as like really like these beautiful open doors, you know? Because what if you had been given more time and appropriate resources to allow the space for her expression to fully resolve? Like, she is going to get to a place where she's ready to light that cigarette, and then allow a little bit more time and space to where you use that as an opportunity to really build, to really get somewhere. But we're not doing that. The response is shut that shit down. Mm-hmm. Punish her. You don't want to act right? Cool. You get to go live outside again. And I have the power to say that, you know? And, but if you had been allowed like some breathing room, really, you know, cause I worked with some folks who are, you know, complicated, right? Like, they come at you and into this moment in very complicated ways. And, I have found that what has worked beautifully for us to build trust and build something is to let that moment of that upset and frustration and anger hit a crescendo, and then let it come down again. Let it come down again. And we are in a different place. We've gone somewhere together. And now we can have a conversation about what this looks like and what care makes sense for you. Because this might not make sense. Maybe she's isolated. Maybe she needed attention, someone to talk to, right? Like, there are all these reasons why she might be expressing that in that behavior. So it's just really unfortunate that the infrastructure, like the system involved in allegedly providing services, does not have the capacity to do what really takes, you know, what it really takes to like know someone.
It's warehousing.
Yes.
It's warehousing a certain class of people so they don't infect another class of people. Absolutely. And if I'm working in the building, I am in the same class as the people that I'm supposed to be servicing.
Yeah.
And the Uber drivers are the same way. They come in there. Like, everyone in that immediate area, everyone in that zip code is the sacrificial class. Mm-hmm. And so there, you know, when you think about a hotel, they're not designed to be shelters where you can actually have good access and monitor people. They're designed for people to have autonomy. Mm-hmm. And we gave people that. Which a lot of them wanted and appreciated. Yeah, a lot of them appreciated it. But then there was also a lot of severe cases like that where the isolation is really hard.
Yeah, it is very. You lose your whole network, you know. And this is a lot of folks I knew weren't, even if, gosh, they were sick, they were ready and afraid, but more afraid of losing that day-to-day contact with friends and family and, you know, just ability to move outside.
the ones that are COVID shelters, it's 23 hours a day inside.
I know. Yep.
3 20-minute breaks. So,
man, that's
you know, and then after 14 days, kick rocks. You got to go. Maybe you get into to the bigger one that's COVID free, but a lot of them got to go. Where they go, cats don't know. And, you know, it makes you look at everything and go, Jesus, some people just really like patting themselves on the back.
There's that piece.
And there's a lot of people involved, way higher up than anybody that I was seeing, because those people don't come by, that are getting a nice check.
Promotions.
Oh, there was a lot of promotions that went around. That went around. Mm-hmm. And I got one.
I did too.
It was only $1.50. I think they gave it to me to shut me the fuck up.
Yeah, well, yes, I can relate.
But I'm sad because I see a bigger picture. And when I say a bigger picture, I definitely was trying to be quiet for a long time because I was like, I think if I'm quiet enough, I could probably turn this place into a really cool, like, socialist paradise. Oh, if I'm just quiet about my displeasure with certain things. Yeah. And I'll try to work within their rules, and they're letting me do a lot right now with, like, schooling, because mm-hmm. we had kids there that weren't in school, and we had guests there that used to teach. So it definitely helped them.
Yeah.
But just the lack of safety standards all around, from COVID to just the violence problem, the domestic violence problem that no one really cared about. There's part of the hotel that's a 6-story tower, and most of it is 2 stories. But the cameras were never designed to be shown on the second floor, because it was a hotel. Yeah. So they just want people to see the parking lot, right? That's what you want to see. Someone's breaking in your car. So, you know, we definitely had a lot of incidents on the second floor we didn't know what really happened. There were certain people that were like, the security guards are coming here, and because no one got keys. Security's job was to open the doors for people. And they're like, the security's using the vacant rooms, and they're screwing the guests here.
Wow. Yeah.
For, like, favors. And, you know.
Sounds a lot like prison, right?
A little bit. Yep. It's a little prison-y.
Yeah.
And you don't want it to be like that, right? That was the constant fight that I'd have with people. They'd be like, this is like prison. I was like, well, kind of, I guess, but you can leave in prison. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't leave in prison. You can leave here, because I had the non-COVID site, so they come and go. I was like, you can leave, like, right now. You can go to the store. Yeah. Like, you can go for a walk. Like, you can do a lot of shit you can't do inside.
Yeah.
But I get it.
Yeah.
I got it. But it's just that whole, like, you want it to be good, because it's like, damn, this is the perfect opportunity for great shit to happen, not just in my state, but across the country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This could be the model of moving forward, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that missed opportunity has a lot to do with my guess. It's my guess. I have nothing to substantiate this. I think that this project mm-hmm. came to be, as you've mentioned, more so as a result of a housed class wanting to know that the government is going to make sure they aren't infected by an unhoused class. And so the creation of the project is to satisfy that complaint. It's not to satisfy the complaint from advocates or unhoused people, like, hey, I need a safe place to be. The project is put in place to satisfy essentially NIMBYs who want people out of sight. Mm-hmm. And then it's repackaged, though, to look like and feel like and talk like this altruistic, we take care of our own, et cetera. But the interior of it, like the organs and the bones and all the stuff that makes it go, is not that. We see that in a lot of these kinds of initiatives, right? Mm-hmm. And they're career makers. I know quite a few people who had very significant promotions within the agency I worked with, significant pay raises during this time. And lots of power, and some of these people were very truthful about their own feelings about how these systems are working and the flaws and the problems in working with law enforcement and what that does to our communities. And when given an opportunity to voice those concerns in this moment, they didn't. They actually did a lot to silence those criticisms and took a promotion, right? And so it's very difficult for me. I don't really have. Yeah, I just think we're going to do it. We're going to house our people. Like that's where it's at now. I don't listen to anything electeds or large agencies are saying about what they promised to do. Now it has to be political force and legislation.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do it ourselves, right? I trust the people that are doing work on the ground every day for no salary, with no funding, with no nonprofit status or any of this bullshit like Streetwatch LA. They get things out to people within hours, moments' notice. We had the fires. The fires are still raging. My home is very near the San Gabriel Mountains, and I belong to that place. I love this land here, and so it's been a very sad time to watch these mountains burning, and the health risks involved in just being outside are huge down here. And it's like, so Mayor Garcetti issues all these like, please stay inside, it's better for your health during this time, blah, blah, blah. Of course, there's no mention made for the tens of thousands of people who are living outside, yeah. Unable to fucking get inside to protect themselves from smoke and ash. Many of whom are the thousands who didn't get those rooms, who should have been inside by now and have high health risks, right? No mention of them. There's no announcement of like respirators or masks or additional showering sites or, you know, smoke-free shelters or anything. None of it. None of it. And so what happens? Streetwatch LA, K-Town for All, folks come together and within a day, set up multiple hubs throughout the city to distribute these materials to people and make sure they're okay. By the end of the announcement of those hubs that had been, you know, set up throughout the city to assist our folks, the city announces, oh, and by the way, it's like in the evening, it's already been smoky for 3 days. It's in the evening. By the way, tomorrow we're going to have 4 community centers open for about 8 hours each day if people want to come in and get out of the smoke. And these 4 community centers are situated in places throughout the city where very few unhoused people live. And in order to get to them, you need to, you know, get on a bus, you need to leave your camp. Like there's all kinds of, so it's just like a ridiculous, it's just ridiculous. It's laughable. And all that is like, oh, let's try to cover some of the embarrassment we feel that these political misfits out here doing this beautiful work have undermined our authority by doing what we should be doing in the first place. They ended up calling the cops on one of the hubs that set up near Mid City, calling the police on one of these hubs that was distributing masks for folks and other kind of respiratory supplies.
They call the police on people handing out masks.
Yeah, they had a helicopter, which someone noted cost about $1,200 an hour to fly this LAPD helicopter. And, you know, the truth is, and they noted this in their report back about this occurrence, someone from K-Town for All, you know, for the 3 hours that you flew over a little pop-up tent that was distributing masks, what could you have paid for? But no, we have 3 cops sitting in a $1,200 an hour helicopter to try to intimidate people who are doing this work. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Priorities.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to control. And if the resources were, this is what they're saying, we want to control. If the resources we have aren't going to control and or punishment toward our long-term goals, which we all know what it is, keeping that check, then we're going to vilify you. We're going to make you look like you are the outsider who doesn't know what they're talking about, which is what ends up happening in the narrative. Advocates end up getting this sort of story plastered sort of onto them about not knowing what they're talking about, they're being too reactionary, et cetera, when really what's happening is there's like this impulse to respond to a literal humanitarian crisis and pay attention to suffering and respond to it. And that's just to tell that truth is to undermine, you know, the careers that people are trying to build. And I think that's too much for them to bear. It's fucked up.
No, it is. It is fucked up. Yeah. Maybe that's the title of this episode. It's fucked up. Shit's fucked.
Oh, you laugh or you cry, right? Like, I do a lot of crying too.
I was trying to think of a title. I tried to think of titles beforehand, and I couldn't think of one. But maybe shit's fucked up.
Yes,
is the title. That won't be the title because it has to go on Apple. I just found out I'm ranked number 18 in Malaysia.
Wow, that's good.
I don't know.
What's happened in Malaysia? That's
I don't know. Exciting. Maybe nothing. Maybe that's why I'm up there so high, because there's nothing going on. And they listen to this to be like, dude, the U.S. sucks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, we're going to stay right here.
Stay our asses in Malaysia. Is there anything you want to promote or shout out before we go?
Oh, man. I think I've given a holler to all of the beautiful people in Los Angeles doing this wonderful work, but also wanted to underline, okay, to leave it maybe on a positive, inspiring note.
We have to.
Echo Park in Los Angeles. This is the vision for transformative city planning. There has been an encampment, aka informal settlement, established at Echo Park Lake in Los Angeles in Council District 13, High Mitchell Farrell, for a long time now. And this group of folks are putting together, really, they're embodying, I think, what is possible for this city. They're showing us, they're not talking, they're showing us. Folks who live in the park have put together a security team to help make sure folks are safe and to de-escalate any kind of conflicts that come up. They have a whole crew of people who take care of the maintenance of the park, where they're picking up trash, they're taking care of the land, they're planting plants. They've established a pantry for people to, if they show up at the park and they don't have what they need, they're able to access what they need, including tents if they don't have a tent. They have a lot going on in terms of programming and doing a lot of popular education spaces where they have reading groups. There's opportunity for folks to participate culturally and spiritually as well. There's a lot of people who are involved in sort of spiritual circles at the park, and they're sharing, their wisdoms from those perspectives. And I am personally really inspired by what's happening there. The park has also been, for the last six or 8 months now, really, really targeted by Department of the Parks and Recs Department and the LAPD and the Council District. There's a lot of pushback from housed neighbors in the area who want to see this encampment disassembled and disappeared. And the community there is resisting it. And they're connecting with other folks in other camps around the city. And I think what's most inspiring for me is that it shows me a visual example of, like, the ingenuity and intelligence and skill that it takes to respond to public space in a way that, like, carries us forward towards something. I've really started to think about these last few weeks. I've been thinking about the park a lot and thinking about all the good work that's happening there. And, like, God, what a model. Like, what if every fucking public park looked like this? What if anybody could show up to a public park and there's people there that are like, you don't have food? Here's some food. You don't have a house? Here, right? Like, what if the commons, these places we are together, all of us, really, really met the needs of everyone who lived in a community? We already have the space. It's already there. And there's people who want to do it. And there's intelligent folks like these leaders at Echo Park Rise Up that are taking the initiative and modeling for us exactly what needs to happen. All we need to do, people who have access to resources, is show up and assist and do what folks who are experiencing this trauma, the violence of poverty and homelessness, do what they are saying. This is how it needs to get fixed. So I just want to shout out to that beautiful work. I think in the midst of this hideous moment that we're in together that's like showing itself to us. I think that there's really, really beautiful work happening. And I'm just really grateful to be able to focus on folks like that who are setting an example for me. So yeah, just to say hey to those guys down there.
Well, that was definitely a positive note. Yeah. Now I feel a little better.
Yeah, good. Glad. Would you
be willing to come back on the show? I do live streams too. Would you be willing to come back on a live stream?
Yeah.
People, it's interactive, so you get some questions and love comments. That.
Really fun. Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. You guys heard it. She's gonna come back.
Thank you so much.
I'm gonna ask her. Yes. Thank you. You're gonna hear some music. Don't hang up.
Okay.